Today's Tay Show is on case 89 in the Book of Serenity. Case 89 is entitled Dong Shan's No Grass. Introduction. Move and you bury your body 10,000 feet deep. Don't move and sprouts grow right where you are. You must cast off both sides and let the middle go. Then you must buy some sandals and travel some more before you'll really attain realization. Case. Dong Shan said to the assembly, "It's the beginning of autumn, the end of summer, and you brethren will go, some to the east and some to the west. You must go where there's not an inch of grass for 10,000 miles. He also said, "But where there's not an inch of grass for 10,000 miles, how can you go?" Xuishong said, "Going out the gate, immediately there's grass." Dayong said, "I'd say, not even going out the gate. Still, the grass is boundless." Verse. Grass boundless. Inside the gate, outside the gate, you see by yourself. To set foot in the forest of thorns is easy. To turn the body outside the luminous screen is hard. Look, look, how many kinds? For the while, going along with the old tree, with the same emaciation in the cold, about to follow the spring wind into the scars of the burning. Thank you so much for coming to practice Zen today. You are, many of you got here very early in the morning and have been sitting for a long time, really sitting up a storm. It's so wonderful to see that kind of deep, deep sustained practice. People are sitting beautifully this morning and not moving. Right? So at the beginning of this Dongshan, at the beginning of this koan, the editor writes a little note before we get to the main koan. And he says, move, if you move, and you bury your body 10,000 feet deep. So, you know, if you are a beginner, it's hard to learn how to sit still. You know, if you have just been doing Zazen for a little while, you might come in and you might sit down on the cushion, and you might be able to sit very still the first time you do it. But then, you know, you may come back, and one time, there's a little bit of discomfort in your leg, and you move your leg, and then you notice that the discomfort is still there, so you move it again. And then you notice the discomfort is still there, and you move it again. Or on the third day of Sesshin, you know, or the second day of Sesshin, when it's getting difficult, you know, sometimes it seems like you can't find the position that will be comfortable for your body. So you move to this position, and then you try this position, and then pretty soon, you know, beginners are moving, you know, every couple of minutes they feel the need to move. Eventually, they change, right? They enter a different state of consciousness. But initially, if you move, you bury your body 10,000 feet deep. So your body becomes this huge obstacle, right? This huge obstacle when you move on the cushion. You don't move, and sprouts grow right where you are. And when you don't move, sprouts grow right where good things happen, right away. The editor says, you must cast off both sides and let the middle go too. So don't hold on to stillness, don't hold on to movement, and don't hold on to the middle. Then you must buy some sandals and travel some more before you really attain liberation. So here's the case again. Dongshan said to the assembly, it's the beginning of autumn, the end of the summer, and you, brethren, will go, some to the east, some to the west. You must go where there's not an inch of grass for 10,000 miles. So, in Zen tradition, there are training periods that are called in Japanese ango. And this koan, the conversation in this koan involves a moment when the ango is ending. And so the teacher, in this case, Dongshan, says, look, the summer ango is over. We've finished our final sesshin of the ango, right? And it's the beginning of autumn and the end of summer. Some of you are going, going to go here. Some of you are going to go there. You're leaving to go back maybe to your to the temples where you are in charge. They've all come together for the season of practice. They've all come together for sesshin. And now they're going back to the temples where they live, right? And this is like a training temple where Dongshan is teaching. And so, they've come for training. The training is over. And now they're going back to their particular temples. So the system would be that, you would go back to your local Buddhist temple in your town, and you would be the priest in that town, right? And he said, so the ango is over. It's the end of summer. And he said, some of you are going east, and some of you are going west. And he could have said north and south. But he said, But wherever you go, make sure there's not an inch of grass for 10,000 miles. And Dongshan was famous for this teaching of go where there's not an inch of grass for 10,000 miles. So, this is koan, right? So he's talking about something, but we don't know what. And we have to find it on the cushion, right? The method of Zen is the teaching method of Zen is to let you learn by doing, basically. One way to teach, one way to present information is to give people a lecture and lay it all out and say, each marine animal has a set of lungs and scales and so on and so on. And giving a lecture on the way marine fish are designed. And the students would take it all down. And then you could give them a fish and they could compare the real fish to your notes, right? This is a standard way of teaching. That's widely used in our culture. Right? So you give people the structure, or you give people the way to understand something, and then you let them apply it to the real world. So another example is we teach mathematics. At first, it's just like 2 + 2 = 4. 4 + 4 = 8, 2 × 4 = 8, and so on. You memorize those, and you get arithmetic. And eventually you get algebra, 2a + 3b = 7, right? And then, later you get word problems, right? So, a train is going west at this speed, another train is going east at this speed, they're 5 miles apart, where will they meet? Right? And it has the effect of making math really uninteresting, in my opinion, right? Because you're just manipulating these numbers. 2x plus 3y equals this, and you know, what does that mean? You know, who cares? And by the time people get to the word problems, it's really too late, I think. You know, it's like the math has already become uninteresting. You know, there was a very famous teacher in the 19th century, biology teacher, who never lectured his students like that and said, here's a fish, here's how fish are designed, let me give you a list of qualities that every fish has, and you find them in the fish. He used to just hand them a fish. He'd say, here's a fish, tell me about it. And, you know, the student would say, well, it's covered with scales. And he'd say, keep going, right? And then they'd start dissecting the fish. And, you know, and they'd come back and he'd say, well, look, tell me something I don't already know. You know, fine, I knew that. You know, what else? And they would keep going back to the fish and back to the fish. And, you know, the fact that he hadn't prepared them for the fish actually had a big impact. All these famous, this guy's name was Agassiz. And all of these famous scientists came out of his class. And they said, you know, he wouldn't tell you what you were looking for. He'd just say, look, here's a problem, try to solve it. And I think that's a wonderful way to teach. You know, I myself try to teach that way. I'm not a fish specialist. You know, I'm not a biologist. I'm an English teacher. But you know, when I give my students something to read, I give them something fairly difficult. You know, and it might not make too much sense the first time they read it. And so I'll give it to them, and I won't give them a lecture on it. And I'll say, here's the question, here's the text, you read it, come back and tell me about it. And then I talk about the text with them. And man, you have never seen people pay so much attention, right? You know, the old way of teaching, the way I was learned to teach is, you know, you give the lecture and then you have them read the text. Or they read the text and then you give the lecture and then you try to have a discussion. But you know, if they aren't already engaged, it's a problem. And if you give them a lecture, that takes away any motivation they have to discover something for themselves, because all they have to do is write down my lecture and give it back to me. See? Zen doesn't work that way. Zen doesn't say, here's how a fish is articulated, here's the way a fish is designed by evolution. There'll be this, this, this. You know, the style of Zen is to give you the fish and say, you tell me about it. What did you notice about the fish? Or to say, here's a reading, it's tough, try to figure it out and come and tell me what you figured out. And with my students, I actually teach that way. And they'll say, you know, I think it's about this. I say, well, not quite. And then they have to go back and they work with it some more. And then they say, I think it's about this. Well, not quite. You know, what about this? What about this? You know, in the process, it's probably the case that they want to kill me, right? But on the other hand, you know, at the end of the semester, when I ask people to review the class and I leave the room, I get really great reviews from my students. And they'll say, this was so interesting. You know, he never lectured. So interesting. I learned so much. I never lecture, you know. I give them things to do and let them figure it out, right? So the whole Zen approach is based on this idea. I don't tell my students I'm a Zen teacher, but I'm a Zen teacher, you know. So a koan gives you a question. It asks you to solve a problem, and it doesn't really give you any help. It gives you a method for solving the problem. So in this case, Dongshan says to his monks and nuns, it's the beginning of autumn and the end of summer, and you're going to leave. And they know that. You know, their bags are packed. You know, this is the last, that Seshin is over. It's the farewell address from the Shifu, from the teacher. And he's saying goodbye for the fall. I'll see you in the winter for the winter ango. And he says, you're going, some of you are going to Shanghai, and some of you are going to Beijing. But wherever you go, you must go where there's not an inch of grass for 10,000 miles. And see, that's a really great way to teach. So he's saying there's something like no grass for 10,000 miles. Sit down on the cushion and find it. Find it. You know. So you sit down on the cushion and you watch your breath and you enter deep samadhi. You know, you follow the breath until your mind becomes blank. And as we all know, that blank mind is the door to your big mind, right? The blank, when you sit down on the cushion and you watch your breath, sooner or later you'll notice that between the breaths there's a blank space. And at first it seems just like a little nothing. You just notice, oh yeah, it's blank, and back to the breath. But if you keep going back to that place, that blank space gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And that we call in Zen Wuxin or Muxin. That's the empty mind, empty mind. Now, it's really not empty, but to the small mind, it's empty. So, you know, basically, human beings live in a world of concepts and that are artificial, right? That we have words and ideas that don't fully capture the essence of reality. They just don't. And so, you know, basically, when we sit down on the cushion and we enter that blank mind, we start processing information with like you could say, bigger computer, bigger processor. But the processing is going to take place at an unconscious level. You're going to enter a state of mind that's blank. When the small mind says, what is my state of mind? It just feels blank. It feels like nothing. But actually, when you are working with a koan, you begin to activate your deeper mind. And that unconscious mind becomes active and helps you to work through your obstacle, work through your question. Many people don't know anything about this, you know. You know, if you think about consciousness as a, one way we think about consciousness often as one thing. There's consciousness, right? There are whole philosophies of consciousness. But actually, there isn't one form of consciousness. You know, I think it's helpful to realize that consciousness is like a spectrum, right? It's like if you studied science in high school, you know, you have the spectrum red, orange, green, yellow, and so on. You know, the spectrum of light. And basically, different forms of consciousness occupy a different place on like a spectrum of consciousness. You know, most people spend all their time in just a few of those little gradients of consciousness. And they never realize that the human mind has all these other forms of consciousness at its disposal. You know, so, it's like we spend our lives on a very narrow part of the bandwidth, right? It's just like we're in blue, we're in red all the time. And we never realize there's blue, there's scarlet, there's orange. So most people spend their time in a very limited form of consciousness, or a couple different forms of consciousness. Mostly, connected to pleasure and pain and connect it to fear and release from fear, right? You know, basically attachment and fear and pleasure and pain. That's sort of what ordinary people experience, right? You know, when you begin to do zazen, when you begin to do Buddhist practice, you know, you begin to experience many different forms of consciousness. And when you're working with a koan, you know, basically the teacher is sometimes the teacher is asking you to discover a kind of consciousness that you haven't discovered, right? And the question is, how can I discover a form of consciousness that I've never discovered? And it's especially a big problem because, you know, the forms of consciousness we're familiar with become deeply habitual to us, right? So, you know, if you're a kind of person who is a worrier and you worry about everything and you spend your whole day in anxiety, this is like deeply ingrained habit. There's a couple of forms of consciousness that combine to form that habit of deep anxiety, and it feels totally natural to you and totally the way things have to be. And you can't just say to somebody, stop being so nervous, take it easy, you know, take a chill pill, you know. That doesn't change anything, right? So how can we change our mental habits? How can we get out of our one-color world if it's become deeply habitual? See. In some traditions of Buddhism, they have different strategies for this. So, you know, in some schools of Tibetan Buddhism, they do something called deity meditation, where the teacher will assign you a deity, and you actually meditate on the deity. You know, and at first, this must seem very artificial, right? You're just supposed to hold this image of a deity in your mind. But, you know, eventually it becomes very transformative because the deity, so-called, is actually a different form of consciousness, right? Different form of consciousness. And the teacher often picks a deity for the student that will be liberating for that particular student, right? So if you're a fearful and anxious person, the teacher might give you a deity, right, a certain deity from, say, Tibetan culture or Indian culture that you can meditate on, and you'll suddenly find yourself being transformed as you discover these new these new forms of awareness, new forms of consciousness. So, you know, if you've never experienced, if you've only seen, you know, you've been in an orange world all your life and suddenly you've never seen blue, you know, the teacher's saying, you know, I want you to meditate on this blue deity. And after a while, you start seeing blue for the first time. You know, it's like that. So you know, different Buddhist traditions have different techniques. The technique of Zen is for the teacher not to tell you what you should find, but to tell you to find it. And the method is the method of like agassi, or it's like my way of teaching. You give them the problem and let them figure it out. So the teacher would say to the student, if the person uses this koan to teach a student, there's the whole story, right? Dongshan said to the assembly, it's the beginning of autumn, the end of summer, and so on. But I want you to go where there's not an inch of grass. You know, you'd think, what does he mean by that? You could try to interpret it. But please don't. You know, don't use that, because when you reflect with your discriminating mind, you can't really transform your awareness. The discriminating mind sort of starts with what you already know or with your familiar mental habits, see? So you can't really shift your place on the spectrum of consciousness with your discriminating mind. That's why it doesn't work to tell a nervous person, stop being nervous. Here's the reasons why you shouldn't be nervous, and so on. So what the method of Zen is, the method of Zen involves sitting on the cushion, watching the breath until we go into deep samadhi. And at first, samadhi is just this beautiful feeling that comes when we stop thinking obsessively and we're more fully in the moment. So in our tradition, it's often the case that we ask a beginner to just focus on breath perception meditation, which is the kind of meditation the Buddha himself asked his monks and nuns to do as beginners. So you watch the breath, and at first it's very hard to get past our thoughts, but eventually the thoughts are sort of over on the periphery and the breath is right at the center of your attention. And what happens when you enter that form of consciousness, right, is that the discriminating mind is relatively quiet and you are watching the breath with one-pointed attention. And you begin to stop self-referencing, right? You stop saying, I. You just start becoming one with the object of your attention. In this case, the breath. When you stop self-referencing and you become one with the object of your attention, it usually feels like a weight has been taken off your shoulders. And it can often be like blissful, this beautiful, blissful feeling, right? It's like, oh, that is so beautiful. You know, samadhi means like entering a non-dualistic state of consciousness. So actually there's many different samadhis, right? When we enter samadhi by watching the breath, you often get into a state where the thoughts are very few and far between. And when you unify with the world around you, you feel wonderful. It often feels tremendously pleasant. In fact, it can feel blissful. I was talking to somebody the other day who was describing his meditation practice, and I had just given him a koan. And this was his first koan. And I said, how's it going with your koan? And he said, I don't like it. I feel unpleasant. See? He said, I'd really rather go back to watching my breath. And the reason he wanted to go back to watching his breath is because he was able to enter like this samadhi of breath attention. And it feels very beautiful, very blissful and pleasant. And indeed, most people who practice meditation in the world practice in order to enter samadhi. And samadhi is a beautiful state. It's a beautiful state. You know, you feel at one with the world. You feel safe. You know, all is good, right? And we all need, in fact, you have to be able to enter samadhi to practice Zen. So this state of entering this non-dualistic awareness is beautiful, but it can become a trap, as I explained to this person. You know, samadhi is so pleasant and so nice that many people want to practice just samadhi meditation. And in fact, that, as I say, that's probably the dominant form of meditation practiced by meditators everywhere. You get to a place where you can be calm and centered. And I think many people who practice mindfulness, although I'm not putting mindfulness down, I think they stop at that point. So you've had a stressful day, you sit down on the cushion, and you enter samadhi by watching the breath, and you feel like $1,000,000. And after an hour, you can get off the cushion and go back to work. That's wonderful, but why are you having anxiety, right? You know, the Buddhist idea is that anxiety really isn't produced by what's happening. It's produced by the way you respond to what's happening. So, you know, if we stay with samadhi, we can't really be liberated from the Buddhist point of view. And so, you know, koans are designed to help us not just enter samadhi, but work through our obstacles, right? The mental habits that prevent us from, you could say, exploring the spectrum of consciousness. And the spectrum of consciousness goes from samsara to nirvana, you know, actually. And there's all these states in between. So the way the Zen works is it gives the student a subconscious cue, right? It doesn't make sense to the discriminating mind, but once you can enter samadhi, a good teacher won't let you stay there too long. If you're just sitting for samadhi, that's not a good thing. You know, a good teacher won't allow a student to stay for too long in samadhi. And I myself, when I first started getting into samadhi, I was so unhappy. This was about 40 years ago, that I loved samadhi. That's what sold me on meditation. It's like, now this is great, right? And after a while, I could get into samadhi with great regularity. But luckily, Genki Roshi, my teacher, didn't let me stay there. He gave me a koan. And the first koan in our tradition is the Mu Koan, meditation on emptiness. And of course, it screwed everything up. Because now I wasn't in this peaceful place. I was trying to find out what this emptiness was. You know. So in this case, the koan is, go where there's not an inch of grass. And what Dongshan wants his students to do, they've all passed their koans for the summer, but he's giving them a new koan. He's saying, oh, and by the way, when you get back to your temple and you're meditating, don't stay in samadhi. You know, I want you to work on this koan. So they're going to sit down on the cushion and their minds are going to go blank and they're going to say, not an inch, you know, not an inch, not an inch. See, not an inch, not an inch. And you know, at first, nothing is going to happen, right? They're just going to sit there in blankness and say, not an inch, not an inch, not an inch. But, you know, eventually, something is going to start. There's going to be what the koan collections call unconscious stirrings. Right? It's like you're going to the blankness, and that's like the door into your big mind, and you're leaving the koan at the door, and you're waiting for your big mind to rouse itself and start working with the koan. And I'm sure it's a little bit similar, like if you were doing deity meditation in Tibetan Buddhism. At first you'd just be looking at this picture of this deity and thinking, why am I doing this? This is so silly, and so on and so on. But you know, the self is just an arbitrary construction. There is no substance to what we call kirt, or what we could is not, according to Buddhism. And it's just a set of what we call energy habits. Energy habits, right? There's nothing there but energy habits. So, you know, you say, why am I staring at this stupid deity? Why am I staring at this stupid deity? And suddenly you become the deity. And you assume the deity's energy habits, right? So our technique is a little different. You know, you sit there and you say, not an inch, not an inch, not an inch, not an inch. Go where there's not an inch of grass, you know. Now, you know, actually, that sounds terrible, right? I mean, I myself have a front yard and a backyard. And we don't use any chemical fertilizers. Everything's natural. And so there's a fair amount of weeds, actually. You know. But it's beautiful. You know, get up in the morning and there's grass and it's green, you know, and there's bushes and trees. Grass, it's beautiful. It's, you know, probably we have to get rid of grass because it's, most people use too many chemicals and, you know, it's water consumptive, you know, but while we still have grass in our yards, it's so beautiful. And you could walk through it in your bare feet, and that's a lovely sensation in the morning. So, you know, who wants to go where there's not an inch of grass, right? And so when you're working with a koan like this, not an inch of grass, not an inch of grass, you know, it can seem at first, you know, very uninviting. And you might be working with a koan and you might be saying, you know, not an inch of grass, not an inch of grass. And you might feel this great longing. I just wish I could go back to watching the breath and have my samadhi, you know. Now you're meditating on sort of like this barren landscape or something, right? When you say not an inch of grass, all kinds of associations can spring up. So, you know, you might suddenly realize that, you know, when I was, my father was a naval officer. My family is from this area around the Newark, New Jersey area. I didn't grow up here. My father was a naval officer. And he was stationed in the Pacific during World War II. He actually served, he was in China, actually, helping the Kuomintang government at one time with its efforts to fight the Japanese. And so I grew up on these military bases, and in the middle of the year, my father would get orders to go someplace. So, I remember we were living in Maryland because my father was working for the Department of the Navy, and then he was sent to San Diego because there's a big naval installation at San Diego. And we had to move, in the middle of the school year. So in January, I had to go to a new class, right? And I still remember how difficult those kinds of moves were, right? Because you make friends and, you know, you go over to their house and you eat dinner with your friends or you have a sleepover or something. And, you know, I had a friend named Mark Miller when I was living in that area, and he was like my best friend, you know. I loved Mark, you know. We would spend so much time together and just sit and talk, you know, little boys talking, right? It was so beautiful. And then, you know, all of a sudden, I was yanked out of that world and I was taken to San Diego. And I never saw Mark Miller again. You know, I just, you know, let him go. And then I was in this place where I had no friends, and the kids, I was not, I fit into the Northeastern Corridor, a boys' culture, but I didn't fit into the California, Southern California boys' culture. And if you know anything about little boys, they're very unforgiving, you know. So I seemed like the odd kid out. I was like the odd kid out. And I could still remember that feeling. You know, it's like I'm in a new house, my house is gone, my friends are gone, and I'm in this strange place, and the people are, you know, the kids are sort of mean to me, right? It's like being where there's no grass, right? There's no grass. Why would I want to go where there's no grass? So, you know, that's my personal karma being activated by this koan. And if this is the answer that came up when you're working with the koan, you know, it would occasion an emotional response, right? Nobody likes to be the odd boy out in this third grade, you know. Nobody likes to have no friends, and so on and so on. It's that barrenness is really difficult. You know, I can remember going home and just crying and saying, "Mother, I don't have any friends. I can't make any friends. I don't know how to make friends with these people." And I thought of all my friends, you know, back in the D.C. area, right, who were, you know, we just would spend hours together, you know. We had a box full of marbles, you know. We all had marbles. We were into collecting. It was a big thing, you know. So we'd all have these marbles, and we'd take them out and trade marbles. And I remember being in, you know, in San Diego, and they don't collect marbles, apparently. And no, it was like, marbles? What are you talking about, right? That's for kids, right? So, you know, who wants to go there? And yet Dongshan is saying we should go to a place where there's no grass, you know. Now, we all have different karma. So, you know, you might, you know, maybe you you hated mowing the lawn when you were a kid, and the idea of living where there's no grass is exciting, right? So finally, you know, no grass, right? So you might enter this koan in a very different way. In fact, you know, I don't like mowing the grass myself, you know. Or, you know, you might have grown up in the Southwest, and, you know, when you're out on the prairie, there's no grass, and that's beautiful for you, right? You know. So we all bring to the koan activates in us different karma, right? And it has a transformative effect in different ways, but it's taking us, you could say, in the same direction. You know, when we when I left the D.C. area, very painful and difficult for me. I went to San Diego, and, you know, eventually I did make some friends, right? And you know, those friends eventually became almost like Mark Miller, right? You know, I adapted. I figured out how to be a boy in Southern California in the late 60s, right? And then I moved again. We moved up to Seattle, at the Bangor Naval Weapons Station outside of Seattle. And, you know, it wasn't so hard. It wasn't so hard because I had figured out how to handle that situation, right? You know, I lost my friends again. I had to make new friends. You know, it was less frightening for me. The more I did it, you know. And I think I didn't consciously discover that, but, you know, I do think I kind of discovered something. You know, there's a part of us that is, you know, when I was living in Baltimore or D.C. area, you know, and I had my friend Mark Miller, you know, if you had said, "Who are you, Kurt?" I'd say, "Well, I live at 1779 Northern Parkway, Baltimore, Maryland, and my best friends are Freddie and Mark, and I have a box of marbles, and I love Zorro," right? You know, Zorro. You know, I lost all of those things, and something kept going. That was still, something's still there, right? All the things that were me were gone. But something kept going. And, you know, when I lived in Southern California, I really became a rather different person. You know, I had to get interested in athletics because everybody was athletic. You know, and if somebody asked me, "Who are you then?" I would have given a kind of a different answer. I wouldn't have said, "I have a box of marbles and I love Zorro." I would have said some very different things. When I went to Seattle, I was much older, right? So now, you know, I was into science fiction. I would say, "Oh, I love science, you know, I love science fiction. Have you ever read, you know, Ray Bradbury? This is amazing, you know." Basically, somehow we're able to become different people. There's something that, in spite of all this change, that doesn't change, right? In spite of all this change, there's something that doesn't change. There's something that doesn't move. There's something that doesn't move. See, I moved from Baltimore or D.C. to San Diego to Seattle, different. You know, if I even look different in the photographs, right? And I was different. I was growing up. You know, I lost my front teeth and got new front teeth. You know, something stayed the same, but you know, it wasn't Kurt. It wasn't Kurt. There's a way of grounding yourself in some kind of consciousness that isn't affected by what Buddhism calls causes and conditions. You know, you'll read in the sutras, a woman of Zen, a man of Zen, is not troubled by causes and conditions. And the person of Zen is not troubled by causes and conditions because that person doesn't identify with himself or herself. That person lives from a deeper place, which is the place that doesn't change when you move from Baltimore to San Diego to Seattle and so on and so on. There's something that doesn't change in the midst of all that change. See, and if you can find that state of consciousness, you won't be troubled by causes and conditions. That's what the koan wants you to discover, you could say. And my telling you won't really help you find that, you know, actually. So often we identify with the grass, you know, with our situation. So, you know, a friend of mine, he was the director of the Plainfield Public Library for 25 years, and he did a brilliant job. And now he's retired, and we were having lunch, and he said, "I don't know who I am anymore. You know, I was, you know, every day for 25 years I got up and I was the director. And I went to the library and do this, you know." And he was busy day and night. You know, he'd wake up in the middle of the night, "What am I going to do?" Suddenly, all that's gone. And he feels this sense of, like, who am I really? You know, who am I really? And, he doesn't meditate, but I hope he can find a way to ground himself. You know, there's something that doesn't change even in the midst of all this change. You know, he's not the person he was, right? How's that possible that we can no longer be the person we were? Well, you know, he's identifying with his causes and his conditions. You know, when he thought of himself, he said, "Who are you? I'm the director of the Plainfield Library." You know, but actually, you know, you're for a while you're the director, and then you're not anymore, right? So you know, Zen people don't take causes and conditions personally, you could say. So, let's say you do. You know, today we went out and did kinhin, right? And apparently, somebody's having a party. Maybe it's related to Halloween or something. I don't know. There was this bizarre sound coming out of one of the rooms. It was supposed to be spooky or something. I couldn't figure it out. You know, we aren't responsible for that happening, right? And it's unimportant. I hope you thought it was unimportant. It just happened, right? It was really out of our control. Some students on campus have been probably planning an event in that room for weeks. And you could see one of the students brought a bunch of balloons. I can't figure out what they were up to, right? You know, bizarre noises, balloons, who knows, right? But the thing is, you know, that's just the unfolding of events, of causes and conditions. We're doing our kinhin, you know, if we got upset about the noise coming out of the room, we would be holding on to causes and conditions. And it's very difficult not to do that if you identify with those causes and conditions as your true self. But the woman of Zen, the man of Zen, doesn't dwell in causes and conditions. that person knows how to go to the place where there is no grass. Right? There's no grass for 10,000 miles. Right? You could say no self for 10,000 miles, if you want to put it that way. Years and years ago, on Beginner's Night, two women came in here, and one of the women said, "You know, somebody recommended this place to me. She's done meditation here and said it really helped her. She said, you know, I've just started a business, and I'm very worried about it, and I wanted to do some meditation. You know, can you give me some insight into my situation?" And I said, "Yeah, first of all, you know, every time you think about your business, you have to say, nothing matters, right? So your business may be successful and your business may fail, right? But you should just, when you feel anxious, just say nothing matters." And she never came back. Because she wanted to hear me say, "Oh yes, you know, I'll give you the formula for success, right? Sit down on the, just be mindful. Sit down on the cushion, watch your breath, be mindful, and your business is sure to flourish," right? Now, that would be what is said, called in the vernacular, pure BS, right? That would be pure BS. That would be, I would be a fraud if I said that. Because, you know, most new businesses fail. Yes. No, I think she was in the restaurant business. And like, restaurant businesses have this huge mortality rate. It's like 90% of new restaurants fail. So if I said, "No, trust me, you know, if you just do this, you're going to be a big success," that would be the cruelest thing I could have done. I told her the truth, you know. It might succeed and it might fail, but I said, "Go to the place where there's not an inch of grass for 10,000 miles, and then you will be free. You'll be free to fail and free to succeed." See, free to fail. Sometimes we have to fail in life. You know, you have to fail. To say, "Oh, this will protect you from failure," that's doing you a huge disservice, you know. And I'd be lying to her, you know. So I told her the truth and she didn't come back, but I still feel good about telling her the truth. You know, there's something more important. I know, nobody likes to fail. Nobody likes to fail, but there's something more important than success and failure. Those are just causes and conditions. Don't live in causes and conditions. You have to pay your rent. You have to have a job. You want to be good at your work, of course. But you know, you can do everything right, and you know, and somebody. I've certainly had the experience of being asked to work up a proposal and spending weeks and weeks and having it go up and having somebody look at it for 2 minutes and throw it in the trash, right? And it would have been a great idea. Now, I could eat my heart out, or I could say, these are just causes and conditions. A person of Zen doesn't hold on to that. And sit down on the cushion, and if you know the place where there isn't grass for 10,000 miles, you know how to handle that. You know how to handle that. If you can find one person who hasn't experienced failure, let me know. Nobody needs to be prepared for success, but we do need to be prepared for failure, right? Nobody. Dongshan said to the assembly, "It's the beginning of autumn, the end of summer, and you brethren are going out, some to the east, some to the west. But when you get back to your temples, please meditate on this. Go to the place where there's not a blade of grass for 10,000 miles." He also said, "But where there's not an inch of grass for 10,000 miles, how can you go?" See, that's a little complication, but in that place, there's no going or staying, actually. There's no succeeding or failing. It's liberation. But then one of the monks, a very senior person named Shi Shuang, said, "Going out the gate, immediately there's grass." De Yong said, "I'd say, not even going out the gate. The grass is boundless." Now, that sounds like they're contradicting him, but what they're really saying is, when you don't hold on, everything comes alive. See, when you go to the place where there's no grass for 10,000 miles, the world is just green grass everywhere. Everything becomes, this is another koan, but everything becomes your rice. Everything nourishes you if you don't hold on. If you don't hold on. But you can't just say, don't hold on. You have to learn how to go to the place where there's no holding on. Grass boundless, inside the gate, outside the gate, you see by yourself. To set foot in the forest of thorns is easy. To turn the body outside the luminous screen is hard. Easy to get attached to things that cause us suffering. It's challenging to see behind our illusions to the luminous screen. Look, how many kinds, how many forms, for the while going along with the old tree, with the same emaciation in the cold, about to follow the spring wind to the scars of burning. This is like a reference to an old tree being burned down, letting go, basically, letting go.